How did it become possible to just completely deny the value of human life and to become utterly indifferent to the victims? You know, the signature mental state of the Holocaust perpetrator was not hot, passionate hatred. It was an indifference so cold that mass murder evoked no emotion more powerful than the disgust you feel when stepping on a cockroach in your kitchen.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week I speak with Dan McMillan, and this conversation is interesting in several ways. One of the ways is, as you know, I normally have the guest introduce themselves. I always say, you know, I'm going to leave the heavy lifting to you, and I have them introduce themselves. Well, Dan is a little bit too humble to want to do that, so he asked me to read his biography, a short little blurb. Normally don't do that, but I'm going to do that now. So I'm having Dan McMillan on. He's the founder of Save Democracy in America, a nonpartisan campaign to get big money out of politics using voter dollar reform. Dan holds a PhD in history from Columbia, as well as a law degree, and has worked as a history professor and a prosecuting attorney. In 2014, he published an acclaimed book on the causes of the Holocaust. The book was called How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust. He's a really, really great guy. Really, really enjoyed speaking with him. We're going to talk about two big things, and I just mentioned them in the intro, but we're going to talk first about the Holocaust, how you know an atrocity like this happened. We've talked to authors in the past that's had grandmothers and parents be a part of the Holocaust as people who have been sent to concentration camps. We talked for the 100th episode to my grandmother who had a different experience, that she was a German in Germany during this time and was just pretty much unaware as a child of exactly what was happening. She was not a Jewish person or anyone else that was being persecuted. So that was a different perspective as well. She's going to talk about just why did the Holocaust happen? How did something like this happen? And why he doesn't think it could happen again. And it's kind of a good tie-in because, you know, a lot of people in today's current world always kind of rush towards, you know, that type of thing and it being something that could happen again or, you know, our country could go down that path. And he's going to talk about why he doesn't think that's possible or at all likely. He's also going to talk about democracy and how, you know, it's slowly been crumbling in our world. You know, his overall arching thing is he does still have quite a bit of hope in that regard. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. I said there were several things that make this one unique. The second part that makes this unique, and I, you know, I've got to say it, is that I don't do a lot of talking in this episode. In the beginning, I said that he is a history professor, and I do feel like he kind of went into that mode and kind of, it's a little bit more of a lecture than an interview, but that's what it is. I didn't ask very many questions. Dan kind of came with a slide of exactly what he wanted to talk about, and that's what we did. And, you know, who am I to want to interrupt somebody just so I can ask a question that they were already answering? So this is a great conversation with Dan. It's mostly him kind of telling us about a lot of really, really important things. So hope you enjoy it. Here is Dan McMillan. Dr. McMillan, how are you?
I'm good, Jackson. How are you doing?
I'm good as well. We're just going to kind of jump right into things. And I want to talk first about your book. And that book is called How Could This Happen? It covers the atrocities of the Holocaust. But the book is a little different than some of the people I've spoken with before that share like their family stories through, you know, concentration camps and things like that. Your book deals a lot more with kind of the environment of how it was able to even happen the way that it did. So I want you, it's a tall task right out of the gate, but I want you to talk a little bit about the book and then what made you decide to write something, I guess, so heavy.
Well, okay. You know, Jackson, I read my first book on the Holocaust when I was 12 years old. So we're talking more than 50 years ago now. We're talking about January or February in 1973. I can remember it quite vividly. It was The Murderers Among Us by Simon Wiesenthal, who was a Holocaust survivor who dedicated his life after the war to tracking down, bringing to justice prominent perpetrators of the Holocaust. And so the book was a memoir of his own survival of the Lvov ghetto and the Mauthausen concentration camp, and as well as the deaths of most of his family, and then sort of information on the careers, so to speak, of some of these prominent killers that he had pursued. And it just sort of knocked me flat for reasons that I couldn't articulate at the time, although what I did pick up on the time was the murderer's extraordinary emotional detachment from their victims. And I came to see that I intuited something that I was only able to put into words decades later, indeed after I completed my book, after I published it in 2014, which was that this is kind of the only time in history where, you know, the ruling class of an advanced society really concluded that individual human life has absolutely no intrinsic value whatsoever. I mean, in every war, genocide, mass killing, the murderers, killers dehumanize their victims. You dehumanize your enemies in wartime, even if you're not a murderer. Human life gets cheapened. But in the Holocaust, the dehumanization, at least of the Jewish victims, was complete. And the, you know, human life lost all value whatsoever in the minds of, we're talking about 200,000, as many as 200,000 German and Austrian killers who were involved in this. And these were not the scum of German society. Indeed, the larger fraction of them was taken really from the elite of German society. You're talking professionals, doctors, lawyers, academics, high-ranking civil servants, people, captains of industry, and so on. I want to sort of focus specifically on this denial of the value of human life, because this is, I think, what makes the Holocaust, what it's really what frightens us about the Holocaust, because it is fundamentally, it's an assault on the value of every human life, of yours, of mine, of that, of all the people in the audience. And let me spill out a little bit about how this was especially extreme with regard to the Jewish victims, naturally the Holocaust, but also it's relevant to 6 or 7 million Gentile victims of various categories, like 3 million Soviet POWs, as many as 200,000 Germans with disabilities that they murdered just to save money for national efficiency, and other groups as well. But specifically with the Jewish victims, what's unique about the Holocaust among all killings in history, the Jews are the only large ethnic group to be targeted for complete biological extinction. I mean, the plan of the German government was to, what they called the final solution to the Jewish question, was to murder every single person of Jewish ancestry on the German continent, on the European continent. And if Hitler had won the Second World War in Europe, it had in fact built a war machine powerful enough to strike at us in this hemisphere and had established world domination, which he certainly would have liked. I personally don't think that he could have achieved that, but had he been able to do so, I doubt there's any historian who would disagree with me when I say that his next order of business would have been to strike at every Jewish community around the globe, no matter how small, because the Germans, they saw the Jews the way that public health organizations view polio or smallpox. It's a virus. And if you can, if you have the opportunity, you should never pass up the opportunity to stamp it out everywhere so that it can never grow back. And so you also see the radical dehumanization of the Jewish victims in the way that they process their bodies for value as if they were animal carcasses. They sheared off women's hair with the stated purpose of making textiles. As near as we can tell, no textiles were made, but the intent was there. Also, as you may have heard, in the death camps, harvesting the gold fillings in the teeth of people after they'd been murdered with poison gas to melt out the gold. They also used Jewish prisoners as laboratory animals for scientific experiments, and they lived in the camps and in the ghettos. The German overseers lived among their Jewish victims, knowing they and the victims both knew that every Jewish person in the camp They were going to murder sooner or later. There were some that they kept alive to help them run the camp, and they had a sort of stay of execution, if you will. But both they and their victims knew they were going to murder everyone, and they moved among them and indeed had conversations with them and developed in a very superficial way one would appear to even be a friendship with some, with no discomfort, with really kind of the same attitude as that of a farmer moving among livestock that he's destined for slaughter. There might even be a goat or a cow or a sheep that, oh, you know, was sort of a pet, you know, or that you kind of liked. And in some of these camps, like in Treblinka, in Kelno, there was one young man who was sort of a mascot. In some of these camps, they had individual Jewish prisoners who were sort of mascots in a way, who got sort of nicer treatment, but they also were going to be murdered too. Anyway, that is what is all I've always found so compelling about the Holocaust. And so it became important to me to understand how such a thing was possible. And it's an important reason why when I got to high school, I picked up German as my second foreign language. When I got to college, I majored in history and German studies, spent my junior year in what was then West Berlin at the German University when I decided to become an academic historian, that I wanted to be a history professor. I specialized in German history, although I didn't write my dissertation on the Holocaust topic. But across decades, I was always kind of putting together piece by piece an understanding of how this was possible. And I wrote my book, I started writing in 2010, and the reason what my book does, and it's the only, strangely enough, the only book of its kind. It's a comprehensive essay on the causes of the Holocaust. By that point in time, say 2010, you can say that the Holocaust had been thoroughly explained, but the explanation was useless even to academic historians because it existed only in fragments. That is to say, there were libraries full of books about Hitler, about World War I, about World War II, about all the things that went wrong in German politics so that someone like Hitler could take power, about anti-Semitism, about and so on and so forth. But the whole story is really quite complex, and there was no overview that put the pieces of the puzzle together so you could see how they fit together. And that's what I set out to do in my book. And I wrote it for the general public, broadly defined, and put a lot of effort. The published book was the 23rd draft of the manuscript because I wanted to make it as short as possible, as accessible as possible. And I think anyone with a solid high school education can read it without difficulty, which is kind of what I'm proudest of about the book. But it raises the question, why did it take so long, 70 years after the end of World War II, for someone to write such a book? And I think the reason is that, again, because of this radical denial of the value of human life, it has been so terrifying to us that I think that even people who work professionally on understanding it on some level have been ambivalent about really arriving at an explanation of how this could happen, because we have been afraid that we would learn something about ourselves that we cannot live with. And I think the other is also that I think because the Holocaust mounts this kind of, you know, essentially denies the meaning and value of our life, it trenches on the kind of same set of emotions and ideas and needs that religious faith, that religious tradition offers for people. I mean, let me put it to you this way. If you, I'm certainly not an atheist, but I was raised by agnostics. I don't really have the blessing of religious faith. And I think it is a blessing because it gives people a sense of the meaning of their lives, of the purpose of their lives. And if you are devout in the Judeo-Christian tradition or Islam for that matter, you're beautiful because you're made in the image of your creator, and your life has meaning because God put you on this earth for a noble purpose. But if you're raised by agnostics like I was, you're not made in the image of any creator. You're a glorified monkey clinging to an asteroid, right? And your life The possibility that your brief existence is utterly without meaning and significance, you face it alone. And this is not, it's not an experience I recommend. It's painful. And it was that above all that drove me, that compelled me. And I think that because of that, because the Holocaust goes to, in a way, most of us, and certainly I, we tend to find our, whether or not we have religious faith, whether or not we really spend a lot of time pondering the meaning of our existence, I think most people automatically find meaning in their lives by loving other people, by trying to be a good person, by trying to contribute to society. But the killers in the Holocaust pose a double challenge. First of all, they would say to us, well, who cares how much you love people? They don't matter and you don't either. And also, if we're capable of doing this, then how lovable are we? And I think that because of all this, I'm taking a little time to get to the point, the Holocaust has been sacred. And if you say that you can explain it, but with the same methods and to the same degree that you can explain the French Revolution or the American Civil War, then you have profaned it. You've taken it from the realm of the sacred. And I think that too has created an inhibition. And there's really, for well into the first decade of this century, you had distinguished historians saying that the Holocaust could not be explained at all. And we're even hostile to the notion that it could be explained. Because by saying so, you would again be sort of reducing it to making it just another historical event. But of course, the idea that it cannot be explained is preposterous, because the Holocaust was not perpetrated by Martians. It was perpetrated by men and women who, in their emotional and cognitive equipment, were not at all, no different from you and I, from you and me, were perfectly normal, at least until they became murderers. Now, let me, I said sort of early on that, let me just back up a second. I think one of the reasons why so few people really feel they understand why this happened, even though all this has been published, is that it's so easy to get lost when historians like myself try to explain the Holocaust to the wider public, and for that matter, to our students, to ourselves. We get bogged down in sort of all the details of the long political story going back really to the 1850s in Germany that leads Germany to develop, to establish democracy only very late, and that the first democracy, the Weimar Republic, is so fragile and that it is overthrown by Hitler and so on and so forth. And all these details are very important. And that's probably 2/3 of my book is devoted to understanding that narrative. But in a way, what gets lost in that narrative is what you most need to understand. And that is what I said at the beginning, that what we most need to understand about this is that the people who did this killed, murdered the Jews and also murdered these other groups, 6 or 7 million Gentile victims of different categories. You could say above all, because they saw no reason not to murder them, because human life to them had value only in the sense that their goal was the long-term flourishing of the German, the genotype, the German race, as they saw it, in what they believed was the Darwinian struggle for survival among the races of the world. And if your death were necessary to that end, or for that matter, just convenient, as in the case, for example, of the 200,000 Germans with disabilities, then your life was forfeit. And if we could go back in time and get 15 or 20 of these killers around the table, and we would ask them with anguish in our voice, why in heaven's name are you doing something so ghastly, so cruel? I guarantee you, the response would be a shrug of the shoulders and a question they would put to us. Why not? They're just people. And that's what makes the Holocaust the Holocaust. And it's so horrifying. It wasn't really until about a year and a half ago that I was even able to put that into words as I'm doing now. And I still, you talk to almost any other historian of Germany or of the Holocaust, and you're still going to get kind of a narrative, well, there's the Treaty of Versailles, and then Germany was angry at losing the war, and then there was the Great Depression and the inflation, and Hitler comes to power, and all of that is true, and all of that is very important, and it explains why the Germans were the killers and why the Jews were the victims. But ultimately, what we want to understand is how did it become possible to just completely deny the value of human life and to become utterly indifferent to the victims? You know, people often ask me, why did they hate the Jews so much? And they imagine that the Holocaust was motivated by an especially passionate form of hatred. And to that, I can say we should be so lucky, because the horrifying truth is that, oh, yes, of course, many perpetrators, many of the killers did very much hate Jews. But, you know, the signature mental state of the Holocaust perpetrator was not hot, passionate hatred. It was an indifference so cold that mass murder evoked no emotion more powerful than the disgust you feel when stepping on a cockroach in your kitchen. So I've rambled a little bit, but I think that the main point that I really want to get home is this radical denial of the value of human life that we have to recognize as that aspect of the Holocaust that most needs to be explained. The other parts are all an important part of the story, but this is what we really want to understand. But it's so terrifying that for the most part, since now 80 years now, since the Indian War almost, we've been unable even to recognize it for what it is. It's like staring at the sun. It's too painful. You have to look away. So anyway, maybe we ought to, but of course, you know, in light of all the crazy things that are happening in our politics, there's been a lot of talk of whether we're in danger of becoming a dictatorship. And I've even had some people say to me, because they hear of, you know, racist language in our politics, of prejudice or the spike in anti-Semitic hate crimes, are we in danger of another genocide? You know, but let me ask you first, was what I said so far reasonably clear? Did you have any follow-up questions before I?
No, I think that's that. Obviously, it's a topic like you just mentioned that, you know, it's taken 80 years, 70 years since, you know, the Holocaust, when your book came out, to even get some kind of answer. You're moving right into the direction that I wanted to take it. And that is, you've already mentioned that it took a long time for people to even understand it. And maybe some people still don't understand, you know, exactly why it happened. And that's what you tried to you know, you talked for a long time, but if you think about how complex the issue is, you didn't talk for very long at all. And I just wonder how you are so confident, because you could see people say, okay, well, he just talked a lot about how most people still don't understand exactly how things happened. And, you know, you've got the old adage of, you know, if you don't understand history, it's doomed to repeat itself. But you're also pretty confident that something like this couldn't happen again. And that's exactly what you're about ready to talk about. So how are you, where's that confidence come from that you don't think that this is a possibility again?
Well, it doesn't want to say not at all possible, but yeah, I actually kind of, I would argue there's sort of two questions that I think we need to separate out. One is there a danger that the United States could become a dictatorship in, say, the next 5 or 10 years, right, which many, many Americans fear? But then, even if we were to become a dictatorship, would our society be capable of genocide, which is a whole nother step? I mean, you need a dictatorship. You really have to have a dictatorship to have genocide. Democracies do not perpetrate genocide, but just becoming a dictatorship doesn't mean that genocide is going to happen or could happen. And I'm pretty confident, especially confident about genocide not being a threat, because just because we really have become, we, all of us in the Western world, all of the world's advanced, prosperous democracies, whether it's us, Germany, Canada, all of our cousins in Europe or in the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and so on, we have come to value human life. First of all, we're democracies, and you really need a highly repressive dictatorship to perpetrate genocide. Secondly, we're vastly less violent than human societies were 80 years ago. And in particular, you've got to remember that the generation of Germans who perpetrated the Holocaust, a lot of them were veterans of the First World War, including Hitler himself, where more than 2 million young Germans died in combat as a fraction of the German population. If you scale it up to our population today, you're talking about 10 million battle deaths, not to speak of the wounded. Now, if we just come off a war with 10 million dead Americans, we would have a rather different attitude toward violence than we do today. Altogether, moreover, since the Second War, we have seen a rights revolution in all the Western societies, where it wasn't just men with property who had a measure of rights. Women have equal rights. Ethnic minorities have rights. Now, is there still discrimination? Yes, there is. Is there still prejudice? Yes, there is. But compared to 60 years ago, or even 20 years ago, in many respects, in our society, in all the advanced societies, we really do, we have made massive progress, moral progress. We value the human individual. We accord the human individual far more worth and dignity than our than earlier human societies did. Anyone who tells me that there is not progress in history or that things just keep going downhill, they haven't studied their history. And so in that sense, I just don't, I don't see a genocide as being at all possible. I mean, you can imagine if we were to somehow become a dictatorship, you could see this or that group suffering some kind of discrimination in employment and so on. But, and I'm not saying that wouldn't be a horrible thing, but that's a very far, that's quite a distance to genocide. Now, moving to the thing that's, I think, of a more immediate concern, you know, particularly, you know, the, it's interesting, in this last election, both parties accused the other parties of wanting to impose a dictatorship if they won. So it was rhetoric on both sides. And, you know, and because of, you know, because of a number of things that President Trump has said and done that certainly give ammunition to critics who argue that. I offer no opinion as to President Trump's character or intentions, because in my own political work, I need to be completely nonpartisan. But I will say this, that even if for the sake of argument that he wanted to impose some kind of dictatorship, I just don't see how that's possible, because you can't have a dictatorship without the cooperation of the military, of law enforcement, the courts. And although I think our institutions, the democratic form of government has been over time badly eroded in our country, has been damaged. Nonetheless, I think particularly of, you know, I have friends who've served in the military, and I look at public statements by leading officers, those men and women, I mean, they take an oath to defend our Constitution. And that oath is a matter of personal honor. Honor is something that in civilians, most of us civilians don't understand, but this is really, it goes to the sense of one's worth. To break an oath of that kind is to disgrace yourself in the worst possible way. And I just think that I have every confidence that people in our armed forces would defend our Constitution and the democratic form of government to the death. They would absolutely not be party. So there's no, and altogether, people serve in law enforcement. I think the majority of them have probably served in the military. That's a very common sort of career path for people in law enforcement. The courts, you can talk about President Trump and Mitch McConnell having packed the court with conservative judges, and you can argue that, you know, the independence of the judiciary has been compromised, but I think we're a long way away. I think that if we continue down the road we're on for another 30 years, or maybe even only 20, if government by the people continues to be degraded and undermined, you know, here in the land of its birth, then if you ask me that question, you may get a different answer. But I have no concern whatsoever that this last election is going to be the last free election in my lifetime. President Trump is not going to be able to, he's term limited by the Constitution. He's going to leave office. He's not going to be able to declare himself president for life and designate one of his sons as his prince and successor. We're just not there. I mean, you could put Hitler in the Oval Office next January, or Stalin, and even they would not be able to do that. It's just, that's not the kind of country we are. People sometimes try to compare us to Germany in 1933, but you got to remember in 1933, the German people had almost no experience of democracy, and all the experience they had was bad. They were not committed. They had never been committed to the democratic form of government, and the elite of German society, including the military, all of those people were ferociously hostile to democracy and would have wanted a return to The empire that ended in 1918, which was some semi-authoritarian monarchy, or else some new form of dictatorship. So the differences between 1933 and Germany and America today are so vastly outweigh any similarities that is a completely false analogy. Having said all that, you know, this fear about the future of our democracy doesn't come from nowhere. I would argue that the democratic form of government has been badly undermined in this country across a period of many decades. And, you know, that the American people recognize this. I think that probably if you want to understand for me, the most obvious explanation for why Donald Trump won in 2016 and for his enduring support and why he won this time is that I think the people who voted for him recognize that the system is corrupt, that it's rotten, that it's dysfunctional, that the government, that we the people are not being represented in Washington, that the government in Washington does not listen to us, does not care what we think, is not serving us, and people want change. I mean, Trump won in 2016 because he was the change candidate, just as Barack Obama won in 2008 with this vague promise of transformative change, you know, change we can believe in, yes, we can. And in 2016, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders ran as outsiders against the system, vaguely promising transformative change. Trump was going to drain the swamp. Sanders was going to give us a revolution even. But none of these change candidates back then, nor President Trump this cycle, ever offered a plan for change that was going to go to the heart of the matter, because what most needs changing is money in politics. And candidates can't fight the money because they're too busy raising it. And let me just say, and so let me move now to the money in politics question, because one thing that distinguishes our country from every other democratic republic on earth, every other sort of wealthy democracy, is that there is no legal limit to the cost, how much money is spent by campaigns or donated by, you know, interest groups or individuals. And at the federal level, all this money comes from private donations. In every other country, for example, our federal elections consequently cost about, by one estimate, 40 times as much as they cost in the UK and in Germany. And in those countries, in Germany, for example, at least a third of campaign costs are publicly financed. It's essentially taxpayer funds that are given to the parties so that they do not have to rely on private donations, and private donations not play a role. We have a system, on the other hand, in our country where effectively our government is for sale to the deep-pocketed donors who pay for election campaigns. Another way to put this, candidates effectively self-censor to avoid saying anything avoid alienating any potential donors. Or to put it another way, campaign donors effectively choose the candidates that we're allowed to vote for. I mean, elections have gotten so expensive that it's hard to see how you could challenge an incumbent in the House with less than a couple million dollars. Senate campaigns, the minimum price of admission is at least $10 million. We've had races in the last cycle in swing districts that were where there was out-of-state money, you know, where hundreds of millions of dollars were spent on campaigns. The Biden-Harris campaign raised and spent at least $1.5 million. The Trump campaign somewhat less, but and the thing is, you need an enormous amount of money just to get a campaign off the ground, just to be taken seriously by the media, just to be seen as viable. And any idea or even any just sort of problem you might want to talk about, like say you wanted to talk about poverty, or you wanted to talk about how the cost, we Americans pay twice as much for prescription medicines as do the citizens of every other wealthy society, because we're the only wealthy country that does not tightly regulate the price of prescription medicines, right? Well, a candidate that even mentions that, right off the bat, that means you get no money from pharma. And pharma, big pharma, that's one of the biggest donors year in and year out. Or if you talk on the campaign trail about health insurance companies micromanaging doctors and finding excuses to deny coverage and rejecting prior authorizations, or these deductibles and high out-of-pocket maximums, so that even if you have insurance, you can be bankrupted by medical expenses. Any candidate that mentions any of that, well, then there's no money from health insurance companies either. And those are just, you know, there's just a couple of examples out of many hundreds. So that basically any candidate, any policy solution, even any tough question you might want to ask about what's gone wrong in American life and about why life has gotten to be such a struggle for the American people, those questions, those ideas, the potential leaders who might pose them, all of those just die off out of sight, out of mind, because they don't attract the campaign cash. And indeed, now so many people who could represent us in Washington and who could be leaders and who could help us solve our problems and seize our opportunities and really, you know, make our country make our country great again, make our country once again, without question, the greatest and most prosperous country on earth, which we have been and certainly can be in future. All those potential leaders, they don't even think about going into politics because they've already known enough to know that if they say, I want to run for Congress, the first thing question a campaign manager will ask them is, how much money do you have and how much can you raise? And if you're not a millionaire with millionaire friends so you can hold a fundraiser at your country club, don't even bother. And it's to people who have integrity and good ideas and leadership qualities, such a prospect is degrading. I mean, this is really a degrading process ultimately, where now it was revealed, this was 8 years ago, and it's surely a lot worse now, that members of Congress in D.C. were spending at least 30 hours a week on the phone in dedicated call centers set up by their respective parties, dialing for dollars, that's the term they use, to raise money for their next reelection campaign, which, of course, A, leaves them almost no time to start addressing the country's challenges and passing laws like they ought to be doing. But also, they don't have time for us. They don't have time to listen to us. They don't have time. They can't even, no matter how well-intentioned they might be, they can't serve us anymore. They're essentially held hostage by this system and by the desperate hunger for campaign cash. And what this has done is it has over time, and this goes all the way back to the 1980s, really, really before your time. But I can remember because I started following politics when I turned 20 in 1980. And already by the end of the 80s, by the election in 1988, sort of Bush Sr. against Michael Dukakis, like the political conversation had already become really kind of empty and phony and sort of trivialized. And it just seemed to be nothing but slogans and personal attacks. But none of us really knew what had gone wrong. And we blamed the media for a long stretch there, but they were really just the symptom. The problem with the media is they had nothing to report because politicians weren't talking about anything. And what I'm saying is that in a gradual process that no one really knew was happening, the need for self-censorship, driven by the money chase, as the cost of campaigns inexorably rose, the hunger for campaign cash just took one issue or policy or idea or potential leader after another out of the conversation and out of the imagination. It basically gradually drained the whole political conversation of substance. It didn't overthrow our democracy as much as it asphyxiated it. You know, that's really kind of what happened. And that is part of why so many Americans today just feel kind of mentally helpless and confused. It's like, I'm powerless, but I don't know why this was done to me. And I don't know how to fight back. And it's not our fault. It's not because we are weak or because we have lost our love of freedom, because we have not. We're Americans. But you can't fight what you can't see, and even more so, you can't fight what you don't know is there. And that's exactly what I'm saying is that, and the thing is that, you know, what's interesting is that even though politicians have every incentive to conceal from us the crucial role played by money and the way that money has effectively prevented them from serving us has made them completely out of touch from us. Nonetheless, the American people, more and more, you see in opinion polls, in recent polls, 3/4 of Americans, left, right, and center. This is an area where you have cross-partisan consensus. This is actually potentially a unifying issue for the country. We're saying money in politics is a huge problem. We've got to find some way to deal with it. So that's what I, you know, and my focus, after I finished my book on the Holocaust 10 years ago, I started researching and writing what I thought was going to be my second book. It was going to be about money and politics and how we fix it. And then in the spring of 2020, I saw that all these other people, many of them smarter than I am, who had published great books about money and politics, and these books had not moved the needle politically one iota, you know? And that's when I realized that, I also realized that the people in Washington, the people in Congress, even, you know, there are some people, especially progressive Democrats, who make a little noise now and again about money and politics, like Bernie Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez or Elizabeth Warren. But even they, I don't question their motives, but the thing is that all of those people in D.C., they're so dependent on their donors, they can't lead in this issue. So the only way that we beat this, that we the people take our government back, reclaim our rightful say in how we are governed, is we have to stand up, a majority of us really, and demand change. And the change, I think, that has the step that we all have to take is a reform called voter dollars. And after, you know, years of research looking at the different types of reform that have been proposed, and then in the work that I've done in the last 4 years, sort of working with other reform groups and talking with people, it seems clear to me that the best path forward is this thing called voter dollars. And that's the sole purpose of my organization, Save Democracy in America, is to build support among Americans, left, right, and center, for this reform. And the reform is easy enough to explain, because the basic problem we've got is now the only people in our politics who really have much say and influence anymore are big ticket campaign donors. And so we've got to make ourselves the donors. And the way we do that, the mechanism called voter dollars, is that for every 2-year cycle, the federal government would give every registered voter an online account of campaign cash. And you can't take the money out and spend it, but you go online and assign it to the candidates you want to support. And if you fund it at the robust level that we're demanding, candidates who want to serve us can get enough money from the voters to run a competitive campaign, and their opponent will no longer have any excuse for taking money from billionaires or special interests. And thanks to some decisions by the Supreme Court, basically the only path to changing the game in campaign finance that the court will not strike down would be a public financing mechanism like this. And my position, you know, but the question is, how do we get there? I talk about the people having to stand up. I talk about a majority of Americans needing to want this, because, and I really think that the only way that we make this happen, that we get a voter dollars act through Congress, that we establish a well-funded voter dollars system, is if the problem of money in politics and the voter dollars solution become a top five issue in the national conversation in a presidential election year, where literally, you know, candidates are being grilled on this at town halls by voters, and journalists are putting them on the spot and on the televised debates. The moderators are saying, well, Governor DeSantis, what do you think about voter dollars? And, you know, well, Vice President Harris, what do you think about voter dollars? Short of that, because it really has to be something that the great majority of Americans at least understand, and that a large majority of us are saying to poll takers and to politicians, look, we've had enough. We want this. And, you know, to a lot of people think that is just too high a hill to climb, that's too heavy a lift. And I don't. And I guess I'd like to state why I think that, why I'm so optimistic, which is that I think that the majority, we already have a very large majority of Americans out there on both sides of the aisle who are saying that the system doesn't work, that we are fed up, that Americans don't know exactly what transformational change looks like because no one has presented them with a plan for change. You know, I was talking earlier about how we have again and again in the last 20 years given our vote to so-called change candidates, you know, to Barack Obama in 2008, to Bernie Trump and Donald Sanders in 2016, to Sanders again in 2020. And I think this time also, Trump won because he more effectively positioned himself as the outsider who's going to be the bull in the china shop. He's going to shake things up. And yet none of these candidates ever offered the American people ever offered us a plan for change, because again, what most needs changing is money in politics. And there's this catch 22. They can't fight the money because they're too busy raising it. And the thing is that, you know, you have, I mean, 85% of Americans in a poll 3 years ago said that our political system either A, needs to be completely reformed, or B, needs major changes. And it was about, you know, it was about 40% of each, okay, about 50-50 of these groups. But either way, you're talking 85% of Americans saying at a minimum major changes to our political system. And there's so many other indications of the American people's disgust with politics as usual. And but the thing is, it's not enough for everyone to be unhappy with the current system. There has to be a concrete, plausible, you know, sort of achievable goal that represents the path to change. And that's my position is that voter dollars is the missing plan for change, that this is the point that can bring people together, that can rally them. And I say this because A, because it's one of the only reform proposals I've seen out there that truly enjoys bipartisan support. And I've seen the support in more than 100 media interviews on outlets ranging from quite progressive to very, very conservative talk radio. People who disagree with each other on every other issue, but say, this is really great. In more than 1,000 conversations I had with Americans of all political stripes and all walks of life, I'd say 95 out of 100 say, this is a great idea. I also commissioned a poll of 700 New Hampshire voters. It was carried out by a top polling firm, Target Smart. This is in 2023, about money, attitudes toward money in politics and about voter dollars. And outrage over money in politics was sky high, left, right, and center. By the end, by the time we were done with the survey and it explained the voter dollars system, we had majority support across the board for it. And it has also, it's a unifying issue. It can be a unifying issue that brings Americans together because it's a way of saying to the American people, you know, your fellow Americans in the other party, the other side of the aisle, are not your enemy. The money's the enemy, which in fact it is. And also it is a unifying issue because it powerfully affirms one of the ideals that make us Americans. You know, one of the reasons why I'm fundamentally confident that we Americans are going to reclaim our say in how we are governed, that we're going to fix this political system, that we will be once again the world's most successful democracy and the inspiration for others, as we've been in the past, is that every other country on earth, membership in the nation depends on language, on culture, on religion, on, you know, on race. I mean, how do you know you're French? Because you speak French, you're ethnically French, you like the food and wine and so on. We're the exception, the only exception. You know, being an American has absolutely nothing to do with the color of your skin or what language you speak or even where you were born. It's about ideals. It's about individual freedom. It's about equality of opportunity. Above all, it's about a government by the people, which we Americans invented in its modern form and have championed and have given to the rest of the world at a staggering cost to ourselves. I mean, you look at all the Americans who have given their lives in wars fought for the freedom of others. I mean, we've not that we haven't made terrible mistakes, not that we're perfect, we're flawed human beings like everyone else, but we are different. And One thing that makes us different from every other country is that the democratic form of government defines us. And, you know, this money-driven politics, this system under which the American people have suffered for decades, not only is it inefficient and wasteful and corrupt and unfair, it's un-American. It's an affront to the patriotism of every one of us. And this was in the survey that I conducted of the New Hampshire voters, we had a question that they were asked to agree or disagree with some statements about money and politics. And there was one, there was two wordings of it, but it was the same basic statement, which is that America stands for government by the people, and this money-driven politics makes a mockery of our ideals or is un-American. And the agreement with that statement, either strongly agree or somewhat agree, was north of 85% across the board. It's a very resonant. And also, just I have to say, in conversations with media hosts and one-on-one conversations with people, it's something that has great resonance and power. You know, fundamentally, the problem is that the two parties have succeeded at this point in persuading us that the Americans on the other side of the aisle are really the problem and the enemy. I think partly to distract us from their own failures. But ultimately, you know, Americans really don't want to hate other Americans. We would rather like and admire each other and work together. And I think we all believe in these ideals. And I think that every American, to some degree, for me as a patriot, because I think all of us believe in these noble ideals that our country stands for, want our country to live up to them. And I think that voter dollars is a wonderful, very powerful way to achieve that. It also has, you know, the advantages politically that you summarize it in four words, make voters the donors. It's common sense. You know, you've heard the saying, whoever pays the piper calls the tune. Well, if we want to call the tune in Washington, we got to pay that piper. We got to fund these campaigns. And maybe best of all, because it directly empowers each and every one of us. This system says to each registered voter, we are going to literally put the coin of political influence into your hands to do as you see fit. And now candidates are going to have to come to you, not just for your vote, but to ask you for something they need a lot more urgently than they need your vote, for the cash, without which they're in no position to ask anyone for a vote. And that is so valuable, because right now, Americans, people I talk to, I think most Americans feel powerless in our politics. Good reason, because we are powerless, because no one in Washington listens to us, but even worse, but because the role of money is really kind of behind the scenes and is so insidious and consists of what's not being not said rather than what is said, we don't even know how this is being done to us. And so ultimately, I'm really confident that we're going to win this. Maybe we could even elevate the issue high enough by 2028. Hard to say. I'm not going to make that prediction. The two biggest challenges that we face, I think one are just getting the word out, breaking through the noise, because there's just so much information out there about every kind. And the other is overcoming the pessimism that I think so many Americans feel. As I see this again and again, and I saw this in the poll that I conducted and in some focus groups the year before, people will say, God, you know, the system just seems so corrupt now, it's never going to be fixed. You know, it's beyond redemption. And I understand that. You know, we've been promised change so many times, it's never been delivered. We're disillusioned. But how do you give hope to people who don't feel hopeful? The main thing is just to get enough people out there and enough prominent people saying, this is a good idea, this can happen. And so I would say to people in the audience that if you like, you know, what I'm saying, or even if you just think that this voter riot dollars idea is worth thinking about and talking about, I'd be really grateful if you could go to our website. The URL is savedemocracyinamerica.org, savedemocracyinamerica.org. If you could sign up for our newsletter, help us get those numbers up and get the word out. And if you could share our newsletter and our website or one of our videos or a link to one of my interviews with your friends or on social media, because, you know, I go on radio, I go on TV, I go on podcasts, I speak in person, I make my best case. But, you know, the people in the audience don't know me from Adam. But with someone who knows you and trusts you, our message about money and politics and the message that we're not powerless, we're not beat, we can fix this, that message is always going to be 100 times more powerful coming from you than it is coming from me. And it's just a question, it seems to me, of getting to a tipping point. You get enough people out there talking about this, telling each other about it, then hearing about it. Oh, I've heard about it from them and from them, and maybe seeing a few prominent people getting a little more media attention. You get to a point where enough Americans say, oh, wow, we're not beat. This can be fixed. And I think from that point, this is the kind of thing that can snowball very quickly. But in any case, you know, even if the way the path that we find to really taking back our government, restoring government by the people, even if voted dollars is not the path that we take, I have every confidence that sooner or later, you know, the American people are going to fix this once enough of us can at least kind of rally around a particular approach to moving forward. Right now, we're just kind of stuck because we don't even know the first step and we don't really understand exactly who the enemy is. But I think once we sort of keep getting the word out and helping people understand, sooner or later, once Americans know there is a way to fix this, there's no way we're going to take this lying down because, you know, for every other people on Earth, government by the people is an option. For us, it's existential. It defines who we are. If we don't govern ourselves as a proud and self-respecting people in a democratic republic, it's like we're almost not even Americans anymore. You know, we might as well just be 340 million people who live in North America and rather watch baseball than soccer. And that's just not us, you know? So anyway, those are some of the many reasons why, you know, I have every confidence that we are going to sooner or later get this done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the work that you're doing through your organization and going on different media is only going to help that. So we can only hope that, you know, reform happens at some point. You've made this interview extremely easy. You know, I had about 10 questions written, but you went through them all kind of on your own here. So
I didn't give you a chance to get the word in wise. You're so patient, Jackson. I'm sorry about that. I don't know.
Well, in wrapping things up, I do want to just allow you one last time to mention your website, mention the book, kind of shout out all the things that you want people to go check out.
Okay, so if you're interested in why the Holocaust happened, the title of my book is "How Could This Happen?" Explaining the Holocaust, and there's information about the book in on the about page of my website. In my bio, the main thing I guess I would ask everyone to do is to please go to our website, savedemocracyinamerica.org, savedemocracyinamerica.org. There's all kinds of information about voter dollars and about money in politics. Please sign up for our newsletter and please share whatever information from the website or share this interview that I've had with Jackson today. With your friends or on social media, because don't think that you can't move the ball down the field. You can provide us what we need most, which is a measure of validation, you know, a sort of seal of approval so that people say, oh, yeah, okay, this is not a pipe dream. This is something that makes sense that could happen. You can provide a kind of validation that I can't with people who know you personally. So don't think that you can't have an impact.
Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you for the opportunity, Jackson. Thank you very much.
So that was Dan McMillan. A lot covered there. I know it was a different style than we normally are used to, but I hope that you enjoyed the conversation. You know, I had written a set of questions, and he kind of just went through them one by one without me even having to ask them. So I just let him continue on, and it really provided a lot of good information, things that I had never even thought about and considered when it comes to the Holocaust, when it comes to the issues with our system in the United States. You know, those who are not from the United States listening, I hope you learned a lot, you know, about potential issues with our democracy, ways to make it better. And everyone in the world, I think, knows about the Holocaust and just more of insights of why it happened and why hopefully it could never happen again. I think we're really powerful. So hope you learned a lot today. I will put the links in the show notes to everything Dan McMillan, Everything Save Democracy. I do think those are some great resources to check out everything that Dan is talking about. He certainly is a wealth of information, and I think you'll find a lot more great information on his websites. And then also his book, explaining more about kind of what happened within the Holocaust. So I urge you to check out everything Dan McMillan. All of that will be in the show notes. If it's your first time listening or you haven't already, go leave a 5-star rating on Apple and on Spotify. Leave a written review on Apple. Helps a ton. Go follow along on Instagram and on TikTok, Not Enough Podcast, Not Enough with Jackson F on Facebook. Really, really appreciate that. Really appreciate when you subscribe or follow along on Apple and Spotify to the podcast. So many amazing guests in the past, over 250 at this point. Everything from actors to true crime to magicians and all kinds of people. So bound to be some more interviews that you might be interested in. So thanks for being here. Dan, thank you for being here. We'll see you next week. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think, or hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.